What the hell's on the live stream right now that everyone's freaking out about?
Warm it up, Chris. I'm about to.
We're not live yet, right?
But we do have some follow-up. Something happened a few hours ago, thank goodness, because otherwise this would have been a short show. but yeah, we do have some follow-up. So, John, would you like to tell us about how people do or do not play games?
Yeah, last week I mentioned the average age of gamers, and none of us knew what it was. And if someone wrote it in the chat room, I didn't notice, so I apologize for that. But I looked it up. You know, it's not hard to find this information. So here are the stats. This was in regards to both of you saying that you had grown out of playing games and me saying that's ridiculous because most people who play games are even older than you or adults.
Wait, hold on. Neither of us said we grew out of games. That that's going to get us some feedback, which it already has, which is not accurate.
I don't remember the exact quote, but it was something like you just felt like you were out of it. Anyway, everyone responding thinks that's what you said. So obviously there was a miscommunication, and you can feel free to clarify because they keep saying, I agree with Casey and Marco. I also grew out of games. Like, we're seeing those responses. Again, that doesn't mean that's what you said, but that is clearly the message.
Yeah, I mean, what we both said was that we didn't see games, correct me if I'm wrong, Casey, that we didn't see games as like a juvenile thing that you would grow out of, but rather we played games for a long time, and then we, you know, in recent years or, in, you know, after we left college or whatever, we just didn't choose to spend our time playing games or didn't have the time to play games anymore. So it's not necessarily a growing out of it, because that implies that it's, you know, like a juvenile thing. It's more that we just chose not to spend our time doing that anymore.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Our priorities shifted.
Right. It's like the same result, but with a different reason and with less judgment in the reason.
Initially, one of you said, I don't know, I guess I just grew out of it. And maybe that was a joke. And yes, later you did say that at least Marco said that he didn't think they were juvenile or anything. But everyone latched on to the growing out of it angle. But anyway, here is the information that I was trying to get across. I said the average age of gamers and no one else knew what it was. The average age of game players, according to the Entertainment Software Association, which is a trade association that tracks these type of things for video games, is 31 years old. This is United States stats only. I think it's only U.S. Anyway, the average age of the U.S. population is 37.2. So, yes, the average age of the people in the United States is slightly older, but I think that makes sense considering video games were introduced partially into the lives of many people who are alive today. So you don't have a sample. You know, everyone alive wasn't born when video games were introduced. The ratios are 52% male, 48% female, and out of the most frequent game purchasers, the ratios are exactly even, 50-50 male-female. They say 59% of Americans play video games, and here are some stats and breakdowns. Women over 18 are 36%. Boys 18 or younger are 17%. So twice as many adult women play games as juvenile boys do. And they say 51% of U.S. homes have a game console, and there's an average of 2 game consoles in each house that has any. So, like I said, most game players are more or less our age. I'm older than 31. You guys are also, you're both older than 31, right?
I am 31.
Yep.
There you go. So you are exactly the average age of a gamer. I think it makes sense because our people your age, Marco, and my age are basically like video games were invented more or less when we were young. By the time we were old enough to play them, they were popular. We played them. We grew up. We continue to play them. Whereas people who were, you know, 30 years old before the Atari 2600 was introduced are much less likely, I think, to have gotten into it. So we are sort of the first generation of people to have grown up with games, and it makes sense that we continue to play them, whereas the people who are sort of ahead of us may have never gotten into it at all. And I think I made all these points in the last show, people talking about growing out of games and stuff, and tweeting about it and so on and saying, well, I don't do it as much now as I used to. You may grow out of the games that you played when you were a child in the same way you grow out of the books that you read. You don't read Little Golden Books anymore. You don't watch Hanna-Barbera cartoons anymore. Like, there are many things you did as a child that you grow out of, but video games are a medium, and they're fairly diverse. And so even though you, of course, you don't have the time to play games that you used to, because you don't have time to do anything. You don't have time to just pick any sort of leisure time activity. Of course, you have more time for that when you're a kid. But as you get older, you will like different games, just like you like different movies and different television shows and different books. And that, I think, is natural. And I think a lot of the people who say, well, I grew out of games, you know, all I do now is, and they insert like the 3 games that they play, but I barely have time for that. Well, yeah, so of course you barely have time for it. But if you're still playing games like that, then you didn't really grow out of games. You just grew out of the games that you played as a child. It's true that some people never grew out of the games they played as a child. Maybe they played Super Mario Bros. As a child. They love Super Mario Bros. To this day. And they keep playing it. That's fine, too. Same thing with books. I mean, how many adults out there read young adult books as like, you know, and love them? Like the Harry Potter series is a good example, or a lot of these things, even like the Hunger Games and stuff like that. A lot of these books are technically young adult books, but many adults enjoy them. Did they not grow out of that? Should they have grown out of books? Should they have grown out of those specific books? I don't think it's an important distinction, but the idea that games are something that most people played when they were a kid and don't play anymore, I think, is not borne out by the statistics, at least in the United States.
Do people count as gamers if they just have like Angry Birds installed on their phones versus like a console game or a PC game? Like, is there a distinction, and should there be a distinction? And maybe the answer is no, but should there be a distinction between like people who have a couple of casual games on their phone versus people who like, you know, own dedicated gaming hardware or have bought like a $40 or $50 game before?
I don't think they're making those kind of distinctions. I think they consider all games games, and so would I. Like, I don't. If you say, like, well, I don't play games, all I do is, and then you insert some iOS game that you obsessively play in every moment of spare time. Like, yeah, you play games. They do add information on consoles, which you would consider, like, that's not casual, right? I don't know if that's still true, but, like, this thing is saying 51% of homes have a game console in them. Someone in those homes is playing those games, right? And so, it's, you know, it's not like, well, 51% of homes have game consoles, but the only people who play game consoles are the 17% of gamers who are male and younger than 18. Like, that seems unlikely. But anyway, I count them all as games. Like, there's iOS, there are plenty of legitimate games on iOS. I mean, maybe they're not counting, like, Solitaire and Minesweeper, but I think maybe these days those have sort of fallen by the wayside. But yeah, I don't think there's a useful distinction between, well, that's not a real game. That's like saying, that's not a real book. That's just a, I don't know, a mystery novel, a romance novel. Do these not count as real books or something? It has to be, you know, Tolstoy. A game is a game is a game.
Fair enough.
Actually, I do have a question for you. Does Tina get involved in any of the video gaming around your house?
She plays games on her phone a lot. And I think that's where she plays the majority of her games. But at various times, she has been very into, as an adult, very, very into both console games and computer games. But these days, anytime she... I don't want to reveal her dirty gaming secrets, but suffice to say, many certain iOS games that have the ability to get their hooks into people have gotten their hooks into her, and so she is very susceptible to that. I don't approve of most of the games that she plays, but she definitely does play them.
Fair enough. Now, what about your kids? Because I know your son, last I heard, is really into Minecraft. Is that still the case?
Yes, Minecraft has destroyed his life and ours. He had a very diverse gaming education up until the age of, you know, I guess, nine. Sometime in his ninth year of life, Minecraft came in and destroyed everything else having to do with his life. He is obsessed with Minecraft. Has he played any game other than Minecraft recently? I don't think so. He's totally obsessed.
And neither your son nor daughter got into the Wii U very much?
Well, I mean... That's the other, when his friends come over, he plays the Wii U with his friends, because I guess it's, you know, Minecraft is not as much of a social game. So he does still play that, and I assume then the next, you know, recently I've been playing games that he can't play with me, but I'm assuming the next game that we can all play together comes out, he'll play with me, like the next Zelda game or what do you call it? God, I can't even remember the name anymore, because now, yeah, The Last Guardian, if that ever comes out, he'll play that with me. But he's not clamoring to play those games. We have all these game consoles hooked up, and I've been playing games on them more than he has. So, but yeah, like it's natural for kids his age to get obsessed with things like this. I mean, just ask Marco with his Total Annihilation units and everything. You get really at a certain point, you get really into one game. Like, yeah, you like lots of games, but then a certain game comes and it just absorbs you. And this has happened with Minecraft. My daughter, I keep trying to get her to play games many, many times on many different consoles and on the computer. She'll play a little bit of kind of casual games on iOS, but she's just not into it, and I don't want to really push it, but I keep putting them in front of her, and I actually had her play Monument Valley, and that, I think, was about her speed.
I still haven't played that yet.
She just turned 7.
I did buy that game, and have not even opened it. Like, now, ever since iOS 6, I believe, added that new badge on apps so that you could tell if you have an app that you've never launched before, I've really been shamed by those badges on my phone, because it's all games, and I probably right now my phone probably have like 7 or 8 games that I bought in the last 6 months that I haven't even launched yet. Like, I want to be a gamer in theory, but I never decide to spend the time doing that.
Monument Valley is actually a great example of an application that takes advantage of Retina. Yeah, the cloud doesn't matter for games. Who cares? Half of those are low-res 3D things scaled up to. But this Monument Valley has graphics that really benefit from the Retina resolution because they're just such beautiful little finely detailed things. It's not like a typical 3D game with stuff flying all over the place. It's just, you know, it's very precise and it looks great in Retina, I think. The game itself, I think it's more of a casual game. I think it is very beautiful and interesting, but it's way too easy for anyone who's an actual, you know, experienced gamer and plays games a lot. And it's a little bit short. I don't really care about length. That's not like I'm buying it for the length. If it was short and fulfilling, I feel like it just... There should have been a little bit more there in terms of the overall experience. Maybe if it was harder and I had more of a challenge, but I recommend it for lots of people who, you know, who find the games that I enjoy too challenging. So I think that's why I have my daughter play. It's like, well, you'll be able to play this. You'll be able to do well, and it will challenge you a little bit. I think you'd be bored by it, Margo, but you should still just launch it just to look at the graphics, because like I said, it's the rare game that I can't even imagine on a non-Retina screen, being half as nice looking.
So you said that it's probably way too easy for an experienced gamer. So I'm now a little concerned that I won't be able to handle it.
You will. It's not.
I'm kidding. I need to try it. I haven't bought it yet. I keep forgetting about it anytime I'm sitting in front of my phone or iPad just goofing off. And I need to get it.
Although maybe my things are skewed, because I have seen tweets from people talking about, like, not so much getting stuck, but having difficulty, and I can't tell if they're joking. So maybe my idea of what's difficult and what's not is totally skewed. So one of you should just play it. Like, just play through two levels. It'll take you 5 minutes, and just tell me, wasn't that, like, there's almost no choice. Like, it leads you, it is very linear. There's not many places that you can go wrong. I mean, the same could be said of Journey, but, like, it's different. You know, anyway, try it. Homework for you too.
If I try the first two levels and it takes me 35 minutes, should I not admit that?
It will not. The first level will take you 30 seconds. The second level should take you about 2 minutes.
One more quick theory about gaming and losing interest in gaming over time. And maybe this is just me. I don't know. And John, I'm sure you're going to have a good explanation for this. I've found that one of the biggest factors I think that got me out of gaming, and maybe it's just coincidence because it overlapped my age progression and my work progression, but one of the things I think got me out of gaming is so many of the types of games that I enjoyed fell out of favor, and we would get almost none of them made anymore. So, for example, I love 2D platformer games. Sonic, Mario, any of the good 2D platformers, I love those. But almost nobody makes 2D platformers anymore. And like,
incorrect.
Well, hold on. And I did play that awesome one on Xbox Live, the Shadow Complex, I think it's called. I did play that one and loved it. For a while, and maybe now the indie scene is getting this back, fortunately. But for a while, like once the 3D systems came out, the PlayStation, the N64, the Saturn, it became like 2D platformers basically went extinct for a while. And you know, same thing happened with RTS games, where I loved RTS games, as you mentioned, my Total Annihilation phase earlier. Loved RTS games through almost my entire teenagehood, if that's a word. And and then RTSs kind of stopped being made very well after maybe 2003, 2004-ish. Like Supreme Commander was like a big one that was awesome, but nobody bought it, and then they kind of went by the wayside as fantasy and MMOs kind of took over. And so like that kind of bothered me too. And now like iOS, like, and I also love turn-based strategy games, but those are very few and far between and are almost never commercial hits. And now with iOS, like some of the best casual games they used to be great on iOS. You get them for like $5 and they were awesome. And now they've all been ruined with freemium and free to play and all that crap. And so I wonder, like, you know, is this just me? Am I just kind of missing the new stuff because I stopped looking around like I do with PHP? Or is this a legitimate reason why I've been kind of kicked out of gaming for a while? I don't know.
Well, there's two things here. One, there are genres that become more and less popular over time. Think of in terms of movies, like murder mystery movies, where the whole plot of the movie is someone is murdered and you have to figure out who it is. You don't see a lot of them anymore. You do see some of them, but like that genre has become less popular over time. So that does happen. And it comes in cycles. You know, what's popular now, it may not be what's popular 50 years from now, and goes around in circles. On that front, by the way, the reason I said incorrect for the 2D games is right now there's a massive renaissance in 2D platformers, which I don't particularly like because I'm not into 2D platformers, but they're all over the place, and not just indie games. Nintendo has been putting out brand new 2D Mario games that I enjoy way less than their 3D versions, and there's just a constant stream of them, and those are not indie things. Those are like, you know, they're Nintendo flagship titles, but and tons of indie ones. So if you're into 2D platforming, like, you cannot throw a rock without hitting a 2D platformer. One of the genres you mentioned, real-time strategy, the type of real-time strategy game you're talking about, like isometric, sprite-based, 2D map kind of thing, like even before the age of 3D.
Things. Hey, wait, hang on a second. Total Annihilation was none of those, by the way. Go ahead.
All right. I don't know what vintage your real-time strategy games are, but yes, they eventually went 3D and you could, yeah. Anyway, they became less popular. A lot of the reason they became less popular is because computers became more able to do the genres that became more popular. So once first-person shooters started to take over the entire universe and you could do any genre in first-person perspective, so there was first-person everything, real-time strategy games became less popular. They're still out there. I mean, there's still StarCraft. There's the things that they've kind of, that same type of perspective you'll see. Not that, Diablo is not a real-time strategy game, but it's a similar perspective in that you're looking down on like what looks like a little board and clicking on people and doing things. If you get really into a particular game and a particular genre and a particular implementation of that genre, because people are like, well, I like real-time strategy games, but I don't like the ones that do X, Y, and Z. I only like the ones that, like, when I was, I think I talked about Myth on a past show about how much I liked it and it was so different than other RTS games. If you're into those specifics, you may have to wait for another one of those things to come around. But what I would say is that the things you like about that type of game exist in other games, and you shouldn't really be married to the genre. Like, if you just like watching murder mysteries, it's like, what is it that I like about murder mysteries? Do I like the fact that someone gets killed and I could get the same thing out of a horror movie? Do I like the fact that there's suspense and I could get it out of a different kind of thriller? Or am I just looking for a puzzle that I have to solve and instead I should be watching the, M. Night Shyamalan movies with a stupid twist? I mean, like, what you were getting out of those games, the things you enjoy, systemizing things, micromanaging things, do you enjoy like working the tech trees? There's a lot of games you can play now, perhaps like a role-playing game with a big crafting tree and like character development. Like, you may be able to get the same experiences out of different types of games. Or it may be that you just really like real-time strategy games and you just have to wait until something like that becomes popular again. That's conceivable too. And like I said, it's the same thing at every other medium. What kind of books are popular now? What kind of movies? What kind of TV shows? I mean, look at TV for crying out loud. If you are totally into formulaic half-an-hour sitcoms, it's there. So hard to find now because like everyone has to have some sort of twist or angle, and the one-hour drama is, hugely popular now. The one-hour drama was like an aberration, 20, 30 years ago, and now it's like everything has to be this gritty one-hour drama. Like, they make a show about Sleepy Hollow, and it's like this big gritty thing, And whereas, like, the old sitcoms, they used to be everywhere, and now they're very rare, and each one of them has some weird twist about them. So I think that's part of it, but like I said, like, gaming is not as broad as books, movies, or TVs, not yet anyway, but it's getting close. But there's probably something out there that you would get the same type of enjoyment out of. And who knows, like, maybe if you're like, oh, they don't make murder mystery movies anymore, and all of a sudden you start going to see, like, goofy comedies, you may find out, hey, I never watched goofy comedies before, but I really enjoy them. So there's a lot out there.
The funny thing for me is, to take this aside just a smidge, is that I find that I get really into certain games, but only for a very small window of time. And most recently, it's been iOS games. But I think I mentioned last episode, or I might have, that I played Metal Gear Solid the whole way through. I used to love the Zelda games. I played Ocarina of Time, and I don't think I ever had whatever it was for the Wii. But I'll find these games that I just am obsessed with. So I'm looking at my iPhone, and I only have a handful of games on there. But, like, right when the iPhone came out, I played the crap out of Flight Control for forever. When The Incident came out, I loved that. Letterpress, loved that. Tiny Wings, Ramp Champ by the Icon Factory, which is a much better game than anyone, well, than a lot of people gave it credit for. Threes, when that came out recently. So all these games, I'd just madly in love with them, and I'll play them to death. Not unlike what I do when I find a song I like, and then I just never look back. So I haven't played Threes in like a month, and I was playing it nonstop for 2 or 3 weeks. And maybe that's just my personality, but I don't know. It's just the way I've approached gaming lately.
You're in the middle of a letterpress game against me, Casey. So anytime you want to move, like 6 months.
I was about to say, I haven't opened that app in forever. It's not that it's bad. Like, I still do enjoy it when I open it, but I just never think about it anymore. And I think I heard Marco say that you're the same way. Like, I get these obsessions, but then just as quickly as I get the obsession, then it's done.
That's why, like, with my limited time as an adult and a parent and all this other stuff, the type of game that I gravitate to are in two kinds. One is the kind that I can just spend for a couple of minutes of fun, like whatever. So these asynchronous turn-based games like Letterpress or Words with Friends, and Threes, even though it's single player, you know, it's just like, yeah, whatever, just some quick fun. And the other type of game I like is the kind of like the True Detective or the new popular thing of 1 hour dramas that have a season long arc that ends and then the cast changes. There's a couple of shows doing that now. And that, I think, is a good model because people are like, I don't want to invest in this show that could go on some X number of seasons and might not have a satisfying ending or whatever, like Where I Met Your Mother. or How I Met Your Mother. I don't even watch that show. But it's like, well, if people don't have a lot of time, let's make a 1 hour thing, a one season arc that you can consume as a thing and be satisfied with. And so the video games the non-casual video games that I play are ones that are going to give me an experience for a defined amount of time, and it's not going to be open-ended, and I'm going to play through it. I mean, not necessarily that they're story-based games, because Journey is not really a story-based game, but that's 2 hours of gameplay. In and out, like, that is the perfect, you know, it's cheap, I can get it as a digital download, amazingly enjoyable for me, loved it, 2 hours, done. And even something like The Last of Us, I think I don't remember how many hours I put into that, maybe 16 or 11 or 20, I don't remember what the stat was, but that's a little bit longer, but it's a single player, there's a multiplayer aspect that I don't care about, single player game with a story, I play it, it has a beginning, middle, and end, and I'm done. It's not like I feel guilty, like, oh, I never go back to it. Yeah, I finished it, I played the game. Like, it is a unit of entertainment, it just happens to be a longer unit than a movie, but actually a similar length to watching True Detective, for example.
We are sponsored this week by our friends at Fracture. Fracture prints your photo in vivid color directly on glass. They put everything you need to get your photo on the wall or desk into the box. Their prices start at just $12 for a 5x5 inch print. And I've actually used these things. Let me deviate from the script for a second. I have Fractures all over the place, basically. I'm looking at two right now above my desk that are like roughly, I don't know, 17 by 12, something like that. And then I have these app icon Fractures up on the wall in my office for all the major apps that I've worked on or built. And I use a little 5x5 size for that. $12 for that. It's amazing. And it's nice. It's like you don't need a frame. In fact, I don't think you even could frame them. Well, you could try, but you don't need a frame. It's just like the picture itself is printed on glass, and it is a complete product already. So if you look into like buying a frame or getting framed, this is really a massive improvement and massive cost savings. It looks nice, it looks modern, and the print quality is fantastic. So,
well, let me interrupt you. I was at your house recently and got to see Fractures for the very first time. I keep meaning to order one, or order several, actually, of some of my Instagram pictures, but I can't freaking pick which ones I want, which is a personal problem. But anyway, I saw the ones at your house, and I expected them to look good, or even great, and they looked better than great. They really, really, really genuinely look awesome.
Yeah, I'm very happy with them. That's why I keep even though some of these I've ordered, you know, outside of coupon code times, and I still order them because I like them. Anyway, all right. So, Fracture. Every Fracture is handmade and checked for quality by their small team in Gainesville, Florida. See, there isn't a whole lot of great stuff that comes out of Florida, but this is definitely one of those things. And Merlin, of course. This is the thinnest. It's the thinnest, lightest, and most elegant way to display your favorite photo. Now, you can get 20% off by using coupon code ATP, which also lets them know that you came from the show, so please do that. Once again, this is Fracture. Go to fractureme.com and use coupon code ATP to get 20% off. Really fantastic stuff. Love their prints. Once again, fractureme.com, ATP coupon code. Thank you very much.
So we should take note that we have finally, the three of us, figured out a design that we felt was worthy of printing a t-shirt. mostly because we wanted to get it out for WWDC like all the cool kids do, and we were running out of time. So we have t-shirts available for sale. We are recording this on the last day of April of 2014, and they are going to be available for purchase until May 11. Is that right?
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. You have a little over a week. So we'll talk about this one more time and only one more time on the next episode. They are $19. They have basically a stylized version of our show art on the front and a little surprise on the back. I don't know if you want to talk about that or you want to leave it as a small surprise. That's up to you, Marco.
I think you should check it out. I think you should go to the final URL of the thing is teespring.com/accidental. However, we made a little shortcut in case you don't know how to spell Teespring. If you go to atp.fm/shirt, it will redirect you to the shirt. So atp.fm/shirt. You must buy this shirt within the next roughly 10 days or so. And actually, by the time this episode comes out, it's going to be more like 8 days. So hurry up and buy the shirt. We've already sold a lot through past the goal, so this is awesome. Thank you very much. And so these will definitely be printed and made. They will make it in time for the U.S. for WWDC, probably. Internationally, it depends on where you live. We've heard reports of some of them coming right before, some of them coming right after, so we can't really guarantee internationally. But in the U.S., they should be there in time for WWDC. And yeah, so check it out, teespring.com/accidental or atp.fm/shirt.
And keep in mind that since we are so, it's so difficult for us to pick a design that we like, if we have shirts next year, it's very likely that it will be a different design. So even if you are living internationally or can't, or aren't going to WWDC at all anyway, don't worry so much about whether you're going to get it in time for this year's WWDC. If you order it now, you'll have it for next year's WWDC, and next year's shirt, if there is one, will very likely be different. So this may be the only time to buy this shirt. You can decide whether that's a good or bad thing when you go look at the shirt, but please do keep that in mind, because tons of people keep asking me, they want to order Hypercritical shirts, and I did Hypercritical shirts already, and I'm not sure I'm doing them again anytime soon, if ever. And those people should have ordered when they were available for sale, so don't let this happen to you. Order them when they're available for sale.
Yeah, and I also wonder, for those who are international, I have not tried this myself, obviously, but I wonder if you could, you know, arrange with your hotel, hey, would you accept a package for me, or so on and so forth. So you might even be able to get it delivered to your hotel.
I know that is a possibility. So, I mean, the hotels usually will charge for that, but I know it is possible, because I did that 1 year to get a shirt delivered to the conference, to a hotel at the conference. But look into it anyway. And also because Teespring is kind of like Kickstarter, where they have, like, you know, the buying period for a limited time, and then they do the whole run at once. They print them all, and that's it. You can't order them after that. So it is very unlikely, I think, that we will get our act together and make a new design that we like in the next year. So definitely, if you want a shirt anytime between now and next May, you should probably buy this one. All right. Thanks a lot.
Okay. So I was a little nervous about not having a lot to talk about on this show. And then just today, Facebook decided to try their own hand at X callback URL, which was surprising for me anyway. So they came out with Facebook app links, and I should probably point out, I guess it's the Pulse. What is it? Like, it's not a subsidiary of Facebook. I'm not familiar with what Pulse is, but I guess it came from there. Do you guys know what that is? Okay. Good talk. Well, anyway, so apparently it's some, like, subsection, for lack of a better way of phrasing it, of Facebook, and they came up with app links. And so one of you guys put this in the show notes, and it's probably for the best if I read this very quickly. Quote, and this is from their website, with app links, Facebook wants to standardize deep linking to native apps by using special metadata added via HTML. The basic premise of app links is that if a user taps on a link on a mobile device and that link belongs to a website that in turn offers the same content in a native app with better features than a web view, the link could automatically redirect the user to the app if installed on the App Store, with support for deep linking to content inside the app. The goal, according to Facebook, actually, I guess it isn't from this site. Anyway, the goal, according to Facebook, is to provide the best experience to a user who clicks a link on a mobile device with features to control what happens when a link is clicked on iOS, Android, or Windows Phone. Is that from Federico's write-up, actually?
Yeah, I think it is.
Okay.
So this, I pasted in this paragraph. Like, first of all, I saw this Facebook app link thing like 15 minutes before the show started, so I know very little about it. But I pasted it in this thing because it sounds like something I would never, ever want. Like the idea that I'm on a website and I tap on a link and it shoves me, it takes me out of the web browser, puts me into an app and shoves me into some deep thing in the app. I think the example in the video was like, say you're on a website and you see a movie that you like and you want to know if it's playing towards you and you tap on it and it launches a movie app and takes me into there. But like, I know that their example is like, yeah, it's annoying to have to go back to the home screen, launch your ticket buying app, do the same search you just did on the web. But like, if I'm in a website and I found the thing, I would like to buy it there on the web. I hate that little banner that comes down and says, hey, I know you're looking at our website, but did you know we have an app? You should try that. The whole idea that like the app could provide better features than the web view. Look, if I'm on a web browser and I'm doing stuff, I want to just do it on the web. Like, I'm not saying that native apps don't have a place, but if I'm navigating around the web, the last thing I want is to be chucked into an application, deep linked or otherwise. So I do not like the idea of this thing. Like, I'm assuming, you know, people are commenting on this about like the inter-app communication thing that maybe iOS will do something about, iOS 8 will do something about or whatever. We'll talk about that in our WWDC prediction show in the future, I'm sure. But that's about native apps talking to each other and cooperating, you know, multiple native apps coordinating to get a single job done. And I guess the web browser is one of those other native apps. But if I'm on a web page, like I don't like those two things being, I don't like switching between those two things. I don't care how coordinated they can be about where I jump back and forth. I question whether jumping out at all is ever the right thing to do.
Well, and see, generally speaking, I would agree with you that if I'm in the browser, it's probably a deliberate action, and I want to remain in the browser. And the app banners or whatever they're called at the top, they just get in the way and are very annoying, especially in the case that the app is already installed. Well, maybe less so if you're trying to like advertise that you have an app. In any case, the one time where I think this makes a lot of sense is if, for example, for some reason I've browsed something in Safari and I end up on some really heavy media app. Let's take Spotify, for example. I'm probably going to want to listen to whatever this song or playlist or what have you is in Spotify's app rather than in mobile Safari. So for things like that, it makes sense. But other than that, I tend to agree with you, John.
I guess it's not the capability that's bad so much. It's just that I see the potential for abuse. And that if there was a big badge that was like, open this up and insert name of native app here, and it was clear that that's what it was going to do, it's fine. But these websites, these companies are so desperate to get you to install and use their app. I don't know why they just, you know, you get better engagement with our, I'm not going to do Marco's voice.
Brands.
It's just annoying. It's like, I would rather you just make your website good and I'll use your app if I want to. But like now, if we give them the ability to make every single link a potential minefield that's going to take you out into some native app, I'm not enthusiastic about this.
Yeah, I think it definitely, yeah, I totally agree that this has nothing to do with X callback URL or interrupt communication, really. That's a different problem. I think there's a couple problems with this. I agree with everything John said so far, which is that, yeah, you know, there are probably some conditions where this is what you'd want as a user, but there's also probably just as many, if not more, where it's not what you'd want as a user. And yeah, you could then prompt the user to ask what they want, but then that's more clunkiness, more complexity. It's one of those things where I have a feeling this solves a problem that Facebook thinks they have, and they assume everyone else has the same problem, but it doesn't really. There's probably not a good problem to be solved in a good way here. Furthermore, I don't know how they could possibly get this to work very well or very effectively in the real world. Because the most common mobile browsers are Mobile Safari and Chrome, at least the ones that are actually, you know, used for web browsing instead of sitting in a drawer or playing videos. And I don't see, you know, Apple, there's almost no chance in hell they would ever implement this in Mobile Safari. So that's out. Any chance of like, you know, a plugin architecture in Mobile Safari that would enable plugins for this is probably also out. Google implementing this in Chrome, maybe, but Google hates Facebook, so I don't know if that's going to happen either. You know, what's in it for them? Probably nothing.
Does this require browser support? I didn't even read enough of it to know whether that it requires browser support.
Well, in the documentation, I read through all the documentation, and I didn't like it. I didn't think it was very good. I thought their examples were, you know, examples are always contrived, but these were crummy. They were just crummy examples. But the way I understood it is if you tap a link, or if you end up on a page in a web browser, including like a UI web view in, say, Tweetbot, for example, then if you see all these meta tags, meta tags, whatever they're called, at the top of this HTML document, you can say, oh, I can build a URL based on the information in these meta tags and make a check, you know, with iOS and say, hey, is this a URL that you know about? And if so, just quietly, well, I guess not so quietly, actually redirect into the app. So say I'm in Tweetbot, I'm using a browser in Tweetbot, I land on a Spotify page, then Tweetbot can say, oh, I see that there's this app link or whatever it's called, and I see that Spotify is installed on Casey's phone, so let me just punch you over to Spotify. Marco, did you read into this at all?
No, I actually spent about 5 minutes before the show looking at this because I didn't see it before then. But so I could be totally wrong on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's the way I interpreted it. Hopefully we'll either get a lot of emails saying I'm right or a couple emails saying I'm wrong.
Well, the key diagram on the site is the one that's like, hey, it works across, you know, Windows Phone and Android and iOS. And like right away, Apple has no interest in this. And the thing is, if Apple has no interest in it, and I think as Renee tweeted, that's why the link to the Renee in our show notes is like doing this right before WWDC. There's a reasonable chance, I'm not going to say a good bet, but there's a reasonable chance that Apple might have some similar type of thing having to do with maybe like a better version of X callback URL or something. Whatever Apple decides to do that's remotely in this area, that's what Apple's going to do. That's what they're going to support. And that's what everybody on the iOS platform is going to support. Making a cross-platform standard is so hard when one of the vendors, Apple, is just going to ignore you forever. Like, and might potentially do its own thing. Because if Apple does its own thing, people will do whatever the hell iOS supports, because it is still by far the most popular platform for games where people actually give you money, or for applications, not just games, but half games. Anyway, yeah, so I totally expect Apple to ignore this. And if Apple ignores it, it's a non-starter for the Apple platform anyway. And that means it's never going to be cross platform. I know it's an open standard and blah, 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 but good luck getting Apple to sign in with that. Like, your best bet would be to get it to be supported as like a W3C standard, because Apple does support those. But something coming from Facebook and, you know, trying to solve their cross-platform development difficulties, Apple is just not interested in that at all. And that's not to say that anything, because Apple's the one who added that stupid, annoying dialog box. And I complained about that dialog box. It says, hey, download your app. But before they did that, it was every individual website doing something even worse in client-side JavaScript to do the same feature. So really, I'm mad at everybody who keeps trying to make me get their app. Apple adding the feature to standardize it at least standardizes the annoyance and makes it like it doesn't slow down the browser as much, because it's no longer terrible client-side JavaScript running. But
it's no longer a modal dialog box.
Or something that would like animate, but they wouldn't use the GPU's accelerated animation. So it would be like, you know, JavaScript redrawing. It was bad.
Yeah, so reading more on Viticci's article, quoting again, apps that implement app links will be able to scan a link that's been tapped by the user and in a matter of seconds understand whether it can be opened inside a native app through deep linking, fall back to a web view, or offer a way to download the app from the App Store. So this corroborates what I was thinking earlier, that you're in Tweetbot, you land on some page, it looks at the page's HTML and says, hey, is there something I can do with this or not, and then can handle it and dump you into the app in question. I mean, I guess that's nice, but to both your points, without Safari supporting this, I don't see how this is going to be that fantastic.
By the way, this also requires a page fetch. It requires let's say you open an app, you open a link in Tweetbot, it requires Tweetbot to first fetch the HTML of the page, parse it for these, look for these tags, and then possibly offer you the option to redirect into an app. So that's pretty crappy.
Yeah, the reason I put that quote in there, that the one that Casey just read, was not because of the information in it, but because I wanted to shame the copywriter who wrote it, who's like, so the little bit was like, app links will be able to scan a link that's been tapped by the user and, comma, in a matter of seconds, comma, understand whether it can be open. In a matter of seconds? I sure as hell hope not. Like, I know it's an expression, but like the copywriter is like, that's the wrong order of magnitude for how long it should really take to scan for links in HTML. Because if it really does take seconds, there's a serious problem.
Well, and even the wording there, scan a link, that's not really true. It's you know, fetch the contents of a link and then look at the contents to see if maybe you can open it. I mean, that's a different proposition. I don't see this being widely adopted. You know, John, as you said, like if there's no chance that Apple's going to implement this, which I'm pretty sure that's the case, then how much of a standard is, you know, Facebook has a lot of this like platformitis going on, and they always have. This is nothing new. Where Facebook always comes out, you know, that Facebook and Apple both have their, and Google and Amazon, everyone, they all have their own their own breed of arrogance. And Apple's arrogance is well known and well documented. Apple's arrogance is, we're just going to make our own thing, and you can make it a standard if you want to. Facebook's arrogance is, we're going to launch all these platforms and standards that are going to be useful and implemented by everybody, and even when that's almost never actually the outcome to what they make. And it almost always just serves them at best, and even they often abandon the things they make. So, you know, it's I think this is a nice sounding story, but I don't see it being implemented by almost anybody important, and certainly not widely enough to matter.
Yeah, Facebook is not a trusted actor in this relationship,
right?
Because yes, they're trying to make an open standard, but it's so clear that it is designed to solve a problem that Facebook has, which is, how do we deploy our application on all the different platforms? Apple does not have that particular problem, or at the very least has it in a very small version, and that they still make iTunes for Windows. But beyond that, they do not want to deploy their software on every mobile platform. So this isn't a problem they have. And it's like, why would we get on board with this thing that, yes, it's open and trying to be standardized, but it clearly exists to serve Facebook and will probably evolve to continue to serve Facebook, if we're not sure that, like, I mean, that's what the W3C is, the only thing, and even that is just like these big companies are all, you know, on the whatever in these working groups for W3C at each other's throats, trying to fight for the little details of, you know, what image element's going to be used for multi-resolution images on the web, and whether we should support Canvas and all this other stuff. And so that is a forum in which they feel like it's a more level playing field, where all of the big companies are at each other's throats trying to deal with web standards. And whatever gets through, more or less, Apple implements. But Apple also does the thing where it proposes a standard, then implements it and ships it to millions and millions of people and says, well, we already kind of implemented this and shipped it to everybody. Does that help you guys think maybe you should adopt it as a standard, W3C? Like, it's not a... Yeah, that's how standards work in the real world. The sort of, you know, kumbaya, sit around the campfire, think we're all going to get along type of thing. Like, oh, Facebook released it in open standard, everyone should use it now. That's never what it's like.
So what is benefiting Facebook by having a standard way with which to deep link into an app? Because that's the ostensible premise behind this. It's not only that you can launch an app, which everyone knows how to do reasonably easily, but here's a standard by which we define what data you're passing to that app, or that needs to be passed to that app in order to get to the exact content you want. So what's the play for Facebook here?
Well, it's pretty obvious. It's for Facebook's app. It's so that, you know, if you, let's say, you know, Facebook obviously encourages sharing all their crap as much as possible. Let's say you hit a sharing link in something that goes to a Facebook property. They want to be able to launch one of their apps directly into that, so that they control the whole experience and it isn't just showing their web page, or it goes right to their app and they get more information, or they it's faster for the user so they don't have to go through the web first. They clearly want this for themselves. I mean, that's why they did it.
Didn't Facebook just have, I was seeing tweets about it today, or didn't they have like their little developer PR thing or some kind of...
Yeah, it's called Fate.
Oh, God, I didn't even think of it that way. Oh.
Anyway, like, I did not watch this speech thing, but from what I've seen from Facebook in past months, I'm going to pretend that I did and pretend this is what they said. And I imagine that this is all part of the strategy that they have to stop being a single thing called Facebook, which is a website that you go to, or more abstractly, an application that you use through the web browser and other things, and start being a series of more special purpose applications circling around this giant hub of information that they have about everybody. And so I think like things like Paper didn't replace the Facebook app. It just kind of augments it. I think what they want to make is a fleet of mobile applications, the fleet of native mobile applications that all cooperate and interoperate with each other and with the Facebook website to make one single unified Facebook experience. And that's why they want a deep link from Paper into the official Facebook app, from the Facebook website into whatever other app they come out with. Like the idea that they're transitioning into, well, they already were a platform, but they want to be a different kind of platform, where all these different pieces on all these different platforms can all talk to each other and, you know, sort of cooperate. So in some ways it is kind of like inter-app communication, but all their data is on the web and in the cloud. And so they have to, their version of inter-app communication is a way to basically deep link from one application to another into the web, out of the web. So it makes sense from what they want to do. Why do they think they want to do it as an open standard. That just tends to be the way they do things, and I think they would be happy if it became commonly supported, because then they would have some assurance that the OS or the web browsers or whatever wouldn't change in a way that prevents their nice standard from working, you know?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. It just, at first I was like, oh, this sounds, actually, no, this doesn't sound that impressive after all.
It sounds like a cool idea until you think about it a little bit or try to implement it and start thinking about the realities of it and how Apple will never support mobile Safari and everything. It just, it kind of falls apart under scrutiny, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a very good way of phrasing it. What else is cool these days?
Our friends at Backblaze. We are also sponsored this week once again by Backblaze, which I still pronounce sometimes in my head as Backblaze because I think it sounds fancier. But anyway, they're awesome. So Backblaze is online backup. For $5 a month, it's a Mac native app, and that $5 a month gets you unlimited, unthrottled, uncomplicated backup. You know, we've talked a lot about the value of online backup here before, and you know, to quote one of John Gruber's sponsor reads, "If you don't use this, you're nuts." I mean, online backup is amazing. There's an entire class of problems, hazards, events where if you just have like a local clone or Time Machine backup, like sitting in your office next to your computer plugged in, things like power surges, lightning strikes, floods, fires, theft. There's all sorts of bad things that can happen that would affect both the main computer and the backup if all you have is the one in your house. And so online backup takes care of that and a whole bunch of other problems. It's a fantastic solution. I've been using it myself. My wife uses it. We've been using Backblaze for a couple of years at least now. Very happy with it. So they also have you can easily restore all of your files, of course, but you can also easily restore just one file right through the web interface. You also have an iOS app that you can use to access any of your backed up files and even share them if you want to. They just added email alerts so that you can say, for instance, like every I think week or 2 weeks, they email you saying, all right, this is the status of your backups. Here's what we have. We have this computer. We have this many gigs. This is the last time it checked in, etc. So you can always, you know, be confident at what it's doing. And you can, of course, also try to restore anything on the web whenever you want to confirm that. It's also founded by ex-Apple engineers. It is a native application. It's, you know, it's not some weird cross-platform runtime thing. It's a native application. It sits in your system preferences. It's also a little menu bar thing. It's pretty nice. It runs natively on Mac and on Mavericks, and it's also a PC application as well. So there's a 15-day trial with no credit card required. You just enter an email and password, and that's it. And once again, once you go to pay for it, it's just $5 per month per computer. And there's no gimmicks, no add-ons, no additional charges. $5 a month for unlimited, unthrottled backup. It even gets cheaper, actually, if you pay for a whole year up front. So it is by far the simplest online backup to use. Just install it, and it does the rest. Go to backblaze.com/ATP to get going. Once again, that's backblaze.com/ATP, and I use it and also recommend it. Thank you very much to Backblaze for sponsoring the show.
So God help me, but I'm about to bring up comics.
Skip, skip, skip.
I actually don't really have that much to say about the Comixology Amazon thing, but I thought I should at least ask you two if you had anything to say. To me, it seems like everyone is acting selfishly as expected, and there's nothing here of note. But I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think Merlin covered it very well on Back to Work this week, so we'll just listen to that. He did a really good job of covering the nuance of this problem. I mean, I had a quick blog post about it, and I'm not going to rehash it here. Basically, my opinion is that Amazon, as the new owners of Comixology, Amazon is doing what they always do, the kind of thing they always do. It's not really a surprise to anybody, and it shouldn't be a surprise to anybody that Amazon is acting the way they always do. And it kind of sucks, but they have their reasons, and that's it.
Whenever we talk about the tech topics where there's something that upsets, you know, basically, you know, people who are into following the tech industry, and they get angry about it on Twitter and they write blog posts and stuff like that. There's a couple of different reactions that I see that are, you know, sort of reaction types. One is the easy one where people are partisans for a particular company. If they like that one company, they don't like another company. Whatever happens, they're going to find out why this proves that Google is evil, why this proves that Apple is evil, like whatever. Like they have their favorite company, they have the companies they don't like. Whatever happens, those people will come out of the woodwork and do that. So you have people who are really big Amazon fans defending Amazon, and you have people who hate Apple saying it's Apple's fault to come up. You know, that is straight up. The other way is people trying to figure out what's really going on and saying, well, it's really nobody's fault. And they just kind of sort of trying to do the middle of the road type thing where they don't want to assign blame, but they're sad about it. And it's just like, well, it's just the way it is because everyone just has to be selfish. It's kind of what Casey said before. And my reaction to it is always a little bit, I don't know if it's less common or people who have my reaction just don't tweet about it as much. I come at it from like a parenting angle where whatever company that I like the best, like in this case will be Apple, right? Something bad will happen and I will decide that I'm very disappointed in the company that I like. And so
do you give them a thumbs down
instead of taking it out on the companies that I don't like, like, oh, well, you are the company I don't like and this is your fault. Instead, I will say, what is it that my company did that caused this to happen? You know, it's like I'm disappointed in my child, like that I hold my children to a higher standard. Right. I don't care what other kids are doing. Why were you involved? And so, I mean, maybe that's not the real origin of this thing, but that's just, you know, like the way I always think of it is like my first reaction is always to blame Apple. Is it because I dislike Apple? No, it's because I expect more of them. You know what I mean? Like I have a high standard and I'm disappointed in them.
Yeah. And we should point out, by the way, what we're talking about. In case anyone was living under a rock this week and didn't realize what happened, Comixology, the popular comic buying app for iOS, especially iPad, was bought by Amazon. And then like within a month, Amazon did basically exactly what the Kindle app does, which is they removed the ability for Comixology to have in-app purchase for new comic issues. And is that even the right term, comic issues? I'm sorry, I'm not a comics person. So anyway, I'm not sorry. Anyway, they removed in-app purchase. And so now you have to like go out to the Amazon website separately, the Comixology website owned by Amazon, buy the comics there, and then go into the app and download things you've bought. It's the exact same way the Kindle app works. And that's almost entirely just to avoid paying Apple their 30% on in-app purchases. And Apple has a couple of rules that you have to, you know, give them their 30% on in-app purchases, and also that if you have a way on your site for people to pay you without going through Apple for something that is digital, you can't advertise that in the app and you can't link to it from the app. So you can't, for instance, like you can't just have an app or like a link in the app that kicks you out to Safari for a second. You enter your credit card stuff on your site, avoid Apple's charge, and then kicks you back into the app. That's no longer, that was only allowed for like 2 weeks. Then they killed that. So the issue is, obviously, you know, Comixology under Amazon. Amazon did not want to keep paying Apple 30%. And many people are blaming Apple for this, including John, I guess. Many people are blaming Apple, saying, well, they shouldn't be taking 30%, or they shouldn't have that rule that you can't link to your store. And that's certainly, you know, something worth discussing. A lot of people are mad at Comixology because they're ruining the experience here, making it much more clunky to buy things, and probably eliminating a lot of impulse buys. Because what would happen, I guess, from what I've heard, is that you'd get to the end of a comic and it would ask you to buy the next issue, and you could buy it right there and start reading it. And you can't do that as easily anymore. So that's probably going to impact sales.
Let me explain why I blame Apple for this and have blamed Apple for it ever since they did the same thing with the Kindle app way back when. And it's not about the particulars. It's about the big picture. And the big picture is the technology exists to provide an experience that customers like. And not only just the customers like, but that actually is beneficial to the people selling the goods as well. Like you said, the ability to just write in the app, impulse purchase comics. Every comic I've ever purchased in my life, with the exception of, I think, one flimsy paperback anime comic back when I was 15 years old, has been through the Comixology app. And why? Because it is so ridiculously easy. I'm not even into comics. I don't even like comics, but I've got the Comixology app. And if you read one issue, and if it puts that button and says, do you want to read the next one? And it puts a little price tag. Yeah, whatever, you tap the button. Like, that's the whole killer. That is the killer app of the App Store. The fact that you could, with your thumb, go, yeah, all right, I'll do that. And the game goes, and you're like, oh, it's all right. You know, I mean, that's why the 99 cents. So, you know, the barrier to entry is so low. So technology exists for sure to do that. And the experience is really awesome for customers. They love it. And it's usually pretty good for the people selling the stuff, too, because they sell more stuff, because the barrier to buying it is less. Anything that prevents that from happening, anything that says, yeah, we could do this, and yeah, it would be good in all these sorts of ways, but I don't care what the but is. Is the but like, well, they have to get 30% because it's fair and they want to have a flat? I don't even want to hear about the reasons. All I know is that this is technologically possible. It is not financially infeasible, but it doesn't happen. And so you say, well, Apple sets the rule. Amazon is choosing not to follow them. It's Amazon's fault for doing that. This is not just one occurrence. I mean, I guess Kindle is also Amazon as well, but like a lot of businesses don't have 30% to shave off to give to Apple. And you say, well, they used to pay way more than that brick and mortar retail stores. That's true as well. We're supposed to be getting better over time, and that like the value you're getting out of being in the app store, is that worth 30%? The relationship you had with retail establishments, even though they took more off, was much more complicated in terms of being able to ship, you know, for books, in the case of books, being able to ship things back and dealing with inventory and having a remainders market. And like, I would think that we would be having more efficiencies in the system. I'm not saying they should charge less than 30%. I'm not saying they shouldn't charge 30% at all. I'm saying that it is in Apple's interest as the platform owner to figure out what they have to do to make it so that it's a good experience that is definitely a win-win. I don't know if it's a win-win-win, to use the, you know, the business speak. I don't know if everyone's going to be happy, but at least two of the three parties here are going to be happy with this. They need to figure out a way to make it happen. And the second thing that annoys me about it is the strategy tax thing, and that, oh, by the way, did you know that Apple has a bookstore? And they pay themselves 30%. Don't worry. That seems like, is that the reason they're not doing it? Because they want to promote iBooks? Well, I don't think iBooks even sells comics, so probably not in this case. But in the Kindle store, it really burns me that, you know, Kindle can't, you know, if Kindle wants to sell their books inside their app, which everyone who uses the Kindle app would love, they've got to give Apple 30%. And really, there was just, I don't think there's 30% hanging around to shave off of these things, right? And so, yeah, they could just crank up their prices by 30%, but then they have to match the store on the web store. Like, all these rules that Apple set up are made to introduce inefficiencies in the system, to sort of force people to either use their system and therefore not be able to offer people a discount for going to the website or whatever, or don't use it. And people are choosing not to use it. And you can say, well, they're playing hardball and that's Amazon's fault. But at this point, I think it's clear that Apple's strategy of just holding the line on 30% and saying, nope, we're never going to, you know, it's going to be this way for everybody and that's it. It's not working. It's not making people, it's having the opposite effect. People aren't saying, well, what choice do we have? I guess we just got to do it because we want to give our customers a good experience and we get more sales. The opposite is happening. They say, well, they're just opting out. And if they think they're calling Apple's bluff or whatever, I think Apple's bluff is called. Apple needs to do something about it because we want to have, you know, I mean, there are so many other things that aren't as good in Android, but Android at least gives you the option of not paying Google whatever percent if you use your own payment processor.
Right. Yeah. So on Android, you can, if you use Google, they charge 30% just like the others, but there's no rule against using your own. So you can build in your own, and many of the big apps have. And I want to point out also, Amazon, when they sell something, they also tend to usually charge at least 30%, especially on digital goods, especially like for smaller publishers, for self-published people, they actually often charge more than 30%. And so this isn't like, you know, Amazon wants to give more to the authors. It's more like Amazon just wants that 30% for themselves.
Well, the authors will get more, but like we're ignoring how Amazon splits up its money, because that is a whole separate issue. Of yes, you can definitely complain about Amazon. They are not great about, you know, like they want all the money for everything. They want to sell your stuff below cost and give you nothing for it. They want to give your thing away for free. Like Amazon deals with that. I'm just talking about the relationship between Apple and everyone else, because that's where the dysfunction is. Like, if we could address this and we could buy things inside the thing, then the secondary dysfunction would be like, okay, well, how much of this purchase price after Apple gets its cut goes to the creator or whatever. So like, I think that's a little bit of a sideshow, and a lot of people are like, well, this is better because some of that 30% will go to the content creators, and that's probably true, but that's not why, like, don't hang your hat on that as the reason we shouldn't be able to buy things inside an iOS app. It is an artificial situation brought on by a platform owner and someone who wants to be on the platform butting heads, and we are the loser. The customers are the loser in this situation. And in the beginning, it was like, well, let's just see how this shakes out. But now, after all these years, I think Apple needs to do something different. I don't know what that different thing is. Is it a different thing you buy Amazon? No, probably not. Is it a different thing you lower your percentage? You come up with a different kind of deal? Like, because consumers are suffering for it. And that, I think, is the primary response. Apple's like, oh, we just care about making great products. It is not a great product when I can't buy a Kindle book inside the Kindle app. It's just not.
Well, see, I disagree on this point, on that the idea that Apple has to do something, that Apple is somehow, you know, losing here, or they have to. I mean, there's one side of this that's an entitlement argument that I don't think is entirely fair. One side of this is, you know, well, we should be able to do whatever we want on this computing platform because we're able to do whatever we want on Macs and PCs. But the reality is, like, you know, iOS is, yeah, it's mostly like a computing platform, but you know, there's no third party software that doesn't go through the App Store unless you jailbreak, but that doesn't really count.
But this isn't a technical issue. This isn't a safety issue. This isn't a technical issue. This isn't an ease of use. It is like, it's a capability thing that we know is possible. It's an artificial business constraint.
Well, sure, but okay, so this is only a contentious issue because iOS is the dominant tablet platform for people who buy things and read them on tablets that they also use for anything else in the world. So what if the dominant portable computing platform was, you know, what if it ended up differently? What if the dominant tablet or the dominant portable computing platform was the Sony PSP? Or what if it was the e-ink Kindle? You know, then you look at like the e-ink Kindles, no one ever had apps on that. I mean, they had a quick little KDK thing that died. Thank God it was half-baked at best. You know, you couldn't make apps for the e-ink Kindle. Apple could not make iBooks for the e-ink Kindle. Apple probably also couldn't make iBooks for the PSP. It's a game console. Game consoles work very differently, similar to how the App Store works, although probably on worse terms, I would imagine. And so, you know, there's you look at other types of computing devices that aren't just PCs and Macs. Other types of computing devices that are, you know, owned by one company, that are kind of vertically integrated, etc. They work usually the same way that Apple does, with the same kind of rules, or more restrictive, or they take bigger cuts. So, and including one of Amazon's own platforms that is very, very popular, which is the e-ink Kindle platform. So I don't really think that it's that Apple has to do anything here, or that they're necessarily unjustified, or that they're being excessively greedy. So
your argument is that because other people do bad things, Apple is also entitled to do bad things?
No, my argument is that you, as company X or as individual X, you are not entitled to access Apple's customer base on your own terms that you dictate.
Oh, but it's not the Amazon that has the entitlement. I'm having the entitlement as the customer. I'm supposed to be the one that Apple is serving. Like they're reducing the value of their products to me through this fight that they're having with Amazon over this. Like Amazon is certainly not entitled to access to Apple's customers. That's the whole fight is over. Like those two companies are fighting, but we are the losers. We are caught in the middle. And at a certain point, us being the losers affects Apple more than it affects Amazon, because Amazon can go anywhere, can sell Amazon cares much less about who the winner is in the whatever space than Apple does, because Amazon is promiscuous, will try to get you to buy. Yes, they have their own platform too, but it's not like they're shunning iOS and Android. They will still sell where they want to sell. It's us that's losing. And I was willing to give it a couple of years, like to see how it would shake out. But if, for example, Apple had become ridiculously dominant, like they had 90% market share and everything, maybe Amazon would have lost this one. Maybe they would have gone back to selling in the app, but it didn't work out that way. And so now I think it's time to readjust.
I just don't see the pressure being that strong on Apple here.
I think Apple is not fulfilling its responsibility as a platform owner to make its products the best they can be for its customers in the long term, not just the short term. Like I said, I was willing to give them a year or two to play hardball and see how it went, but it is going badly for them, and I blame Apple because they're my child.
I will disagree that it's going badly, but also one more thing. I think Apple could probably look at this from another angle and say, you know, you can't, if you're proposing a change to App Store policy, you can't just look at it as what would good implementations do with that? What would good people do with that? You know, how would that be used well? You have to also look at it as how would that be used terribly? How would that be used by scammy people, by crappy companies like King? Like how would that be used by terrible people and terrible companies? And allowing other in-app purchase systems that Apple does not run would also introduce a huge risk of an erosion of trust in the payment system by bad actors, like, you know, big game companies with in-app purchase schemes, stuff like that, like bad actors having their own credit card input things in their apps that then behave badly.
But who is suggesting that, though? No one is suggesting that.
Well, so that's, you know, one of the options. There's a couple options to solve this. One of the options is to reduce Apple's cut. Let's say they cut it in half to 15%. Do you think that would change Amazon's mind? I'm guessing not. Let's say all the rules stay the same, but the cut goes down.
The most feasible option for them, if you're looking like, what's the practical solution? What do you actually want them to do? Two things. One, on the technical side, they should make it possible for someone with a catalog volume the size of Comixology, let alone Amazon itself. If there's any limit, Amazon is going to hit it with, like, you know, an Amazon.com app, for example, you know, like that sells everything that Amazon sells because their catalog is massive. But anyway, make sure that's all set. Make sure you have a system in place. And then what I would change about it is it's ridiculous that they have this hardline thing where it's got to be 70-30 with everyone. Cut a deal with Amazon. I think it's not insane to, like, oh, it's unfair. Why does Amazon get it? They get a special deal because they're Amazon.com. You are not Amazon.com. You get a different deal. I don't think that's unreasonable. And Apple seems so tied to, like, it's 70-30. It never changes. Everyone is treated equally. Isn't that nice and fair for everybody? It stops being a tenable strategy when your consumers are made to have worse experiences because of, I don't know, what crazy principle that you want, like, you know, in each individual Apple developer to feel fair. I don't think it's unreasonable to cut a deal with Amazon. Figure out what you have to do. The terms of that deal don't even need to be public. I don't care what Amazon and Apple have to do to or with each other behind closed doors to get this deal to happen. Just do what you have to do. If someone complains, hey, Amazon's getting a special deal. When you get to be the size of Amazon, then you'll get a special deal too. Like, is that crazy? Am I breaking secret rules of the App Store by suggesting this insane idea?
Well, it would be breaking with a lot of precedent. Historically, Apple has generally, very consistently enforced the same rules for everybody, big and small, and much to the big company's chagrin in a lot of cases. But they generally do not negotiate major exceptions to rules like that, even with companies as big as Amazon or Facebook or the New York Times or anything like that. They really have not done that.
I agree they haven't. I think it's silly that they haven't.
See, I don't know. I mean, there is, you know, a lot of the App Store and a lot of its problems, honestly, are because of this kind of, like, almost sort of mostly democratic system that it has often been, or it is in a lot of respects. Like, the top list is, you know, famously minimally filtered. And so you see, like, crappy scam apps up there all the time because they're not really monitoring it that closely. And you know, it's worth arguing whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. But most, for the most part, the App Store is run on a pretty level playing field where big companies are not allowed to break rules that small companies can't also break.
Well, it's not breaking a rule if you have a deal. Like, so there's anger in the chat room about this. Let me address a couple of the things. Dented Meat says, do you really think that if Amazon is given a better deal, they will automatically pass the money to the content creators? No, of course not. I didn't say that. I don't think anyone said that. Again, we're not talking about how Amazon divides up the money. That's a whole separate issue. That's totally not what I'm talking about. I don't know what Amazon would do with it. Probably not, because that's not how they work. And then people saying, like, comparing it to, like, bribes and corruption. It's a business relationship. When Apple is buying parts from someone who makes, like, screens or widgets or whatever, they negotiate a deal to buy those screens. They get a better price than you do if you want to buy 10 of them. That's business. That's not bribes and corruption. That's just how business works. You get volume discounts. If you're going to drive a certain amount of business, you get a better deal. I don't think that's corruption or bribe. That's just how business works. It's a contract, and no one else is entitled to see, hey, how much is Samsung paying you for screens? Apple's not entitled to see that. Like, that's individual contracts with businesses. If someone's bringing up antitrust, Apple doesn't have the market share in any market to be even remotely considered for antitrust, except for the crazy people who are going to say that Apple has a monopoly on Apple computers, and I love that one. That everyone gets old. You know, I understand why you'd want to have uniform rules, and that's a good idea right up to the point where it seems like there's some sort of problem. Here, there is definitely a problem. And, like, maybe they can never come to a deal. Like, if they can't come to a deal, they can't come to a deal. But as far as any of us are aware, they've never even considered this as an option. I mean, for another example is they held the line on I imagine a lot of the rumors about, like, Microsoft and Office and why isn't Office available. Microsoft doesn't want to give Apple 30% of its software sales, right? And so that went on for a really long time until eventually Microsoft blinked and produced Office, but they found a way to do it without giving Apple a cut because you have to sign up for Office 365 and all this other...
Wait, is that true? I thought they were giving Apple the cut if you bought it in the app.
For the subscription, you mean?
I thought it was a little of both. I thought that the way that Microsoft hopes you go is you already have an Office 365 subscription you got on your own accord. But I believe, Marco, you're also right that there is an in-app purchase of some capacity that Apple does get a cut of.
But, like, the thing everyone was talking about early on was Microsoft Office will be available for the iPad. It'll be $99 and Apple will get 30% of that. And that's not what Microsoft did. That's not what happened. You know, like, they have the subscription model. And, you know, the apps are free, right? It's a free download.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, so that is, you know, it's a different monetization strategy as opposed to simply selling Office at a premium price and giving Apple 30% of right off there. And, like, in that case, there would be no way to get Office without paying Apple 30%. And now there is a way. You download a free app, go to Microsoft's website where they offer you the same prices, you know, in-app purchase. And even that took a long time to figure out. And I think customers didn't really lose out in that one. And I think Apple kind of won that battle. But the battle over an application through which you naturally want to buy things and consume them right in them, Apple is not winning that battle for whatever reasons. And I think something should be done about it. And I mean, thus far, because Google is so incompetent in this area and has not been able to penetrate the market, people aren't like, well, screw Apple, I'm just going to get an Android device. Because you're not. Like, I think the iPad is still better. You know, like, I think Apple still, maybe that's what they think too. Like, we're still in the driver's seat. Eventually we'll win this. But there's a lot of years of suffering that's gone on already with the Kindle app. And it's just kind of, the Comixology is a drop in the bucket. And we just see a lot of it because, you know, we know people who read comics and are angry about it. But I think it is a type that will continue coming up until someone figures something out.
So what about this as a proposed alternative? So the times in which we all get bitter about the 30% seem to be, so far as I can tell, reselling. So Amazon or Comixology is reselling the comics in their app. What if Apple announced that, hey, if you come to us and can prove to us that you're a reseller, then we'll drop the fee to 15% or something like that. And so for things like games where you're not really reselling anything, then you still have to pay the 30%. And you can't just make a shell company and say, yes, I promise that this shell company isn't me. You have to actually go to someone in Apple and prove to them by whatever means they want that you are simply reselling and you are not providing your own original content. And thus it's not reasonable to give Apple 30%. You will give them the lower tier cost.
But you don't need to think that hard about this. You can do things. If you're so stuck on doing uniform rules for everybody, you just give like volume discounts. If you sell X amount of dollars, we get X percent. And if you sell $10 billion, I mean, like there are plenty, like,
right. Which Microsoft does that.
These are not like new technologies in the world of business. Like, this is how business has worked forever. It's just that the app store is the aberration. Can we apply this uniformly to everybody and not have any variability for volume, so that if you sell 3 in-app purchases for virtual coins versus 30 billion in-app purchases, when you get exactly the same percentage? It's nice and convenient, everyone, you know. But like, again, it's only a problem until like it's making your platform worse to deploy applications on. The Kindle app is worse on iOS in this respect than it is on other platforms that allow purchase. And Comixology just got worse because the previous company that owned it was willing to bite the bullet and give the 30%, surely shaving its margins and potentially also shaving how much money go to content creators. But who cares? They were willing to do this because that was how they got traction. They got enough traction. They got bought out by Amazon. Amazon doesn't need traction. Amazon is Amazon.com. So yeah, they take away 30% because that's what Amazon does. It's not like I'm saying Amazon is the scorpion here. It's like, well, it's in its nature. It's going to do that. Like, I think Amazon does plenty of evil things too. All I'm thinking about is, why is the platform that I use on my tablet getting worse for me to do things I like to do on it? And I just want it to be worked out.
Marco, before you jump in, I'd just like to point out I understand the scorpion reference.
That's because I talked about it on Hypercritical and you listened.
You know, John, you're assuming that Apple needs to address this. And in your position, you're arguing that it is an assumption. You're arguing that Apple needs to fix this. And I just don't see the urgent need. And I think the Kindle app being this way for so long, I mean, it's been, what, 4 or 5 years? Or probably 3 or 4 years that the Kindle app has been this way. That's been there long enough, and it doesn't seem to really be affecting Apple sales or customer satisfaction. Overall, it doesn't seem to be that you know, Apple's really like being held to the fire here, that they really have to change this. I don't see the big push. I don't see why they would have to do any of these things. Why they? And by the way, I think lowering their cut to anything would not please Amazon. I think Amazon wants to own that whole experience and the whole processing of anything.
That is potentially right, but at that point, I could stop blaming Apple and say, well, Apple offered them like 0.001% and they just still rejected it. It's like, well, then it's not Apple's fault anymore.
Yeah, I mean, and that honestly, I really do think Amazon wants to own the entire customer process, not just that commission. They want everything to be going through them only, and so they have full control and full access. I really don't think that a rate cut would do it for them.
Well, the idea that like they don't need to do it because like, well, they've been doing it for years with Kindle and it hasn't hurt them, right? It's difficult to tell what it hasn't hurt them, but like the one thing I would point to, that like a metric, you're just like, well, maybe they would have sold more iPads if you could have bought things. Like, that's hard to prove, like whatever, but the one thing you could point to is good old Tim Cook's favorite, customer sat. customer sat among people who read comics has suddenly gone down. I can tell you that. And I think Kindle app didn't have it, but like customer sat among people who use the Kindle app would go, you know, way higher for their iPads if they could buy things through it. Because think about that. Like some people, they consider their iPad like it's my comic reading device. And like that's what they use it for. And I bet there are people out there who consider it their Kindle reader. And if suddenly those people could buy the things, like they got to the end of series one of a book series and there was a little page at the end of the Kindle thing that said, do you want to start reading the next one? Tap this button. You tap the button, a little spinner appeared for 2 seconds and you're reading the next book. Their customer sat with their iPad would go up. Like, that is a metric that you can track that they talk about a lot that they should be watching. Is it causing people to not buy iPads? I don't know. Like, maybe customer satisfaction is disconnected from their bottom line in vague ways, but they do care about it because that's their whole thing. It's like, we're trying to make great products that make people happy. And here's a case where they're intentionally choosing not to do something that they know will make people happy because of a fight they're having with a competitor about pricing. And like I said, it's okay to do that for a while, but the way it's shaking out, it doesn't seem like Amazon's going to budge. And, you know, customer satisfaction with these experiences is either still not going up to the level they know it could be or going down in the cases where applications have to backslide. So,
assuming that there's no rate change that could get Amazon to actually accept that and do everything directly through Apple, assuming that the only thing that would allow them to offer in-app purchases on Apple's platforms in a way that Amazon would approve would be to do what Google allows, which is to just have their own payment processing in the app that, you know, and Apple would just remove the rule that you can't do that. Do you think the net gain from that in overall Apple ecosystem customer satisfaction, assuming that anybody else could do that same thing, assuming that anyone, you know, as I said earlier, like assuming that, you know, King could put their own payment system in Candy Crush to make 30% more, and that any random app could put their own credit card system in.
But you keep going back to your own payment system. No one is suggesting that. I would never suggest that people be able to do their own payment systems.
So you're basically putting forth the idea that Apple should negotiate a lower rate with Amazon, and that Amazon would probably accept a lower rate.
It's not just Amazon. Like, say Amazon plays hardball and like, we will not give you a red cent. You'll never get anything if you don't, you know, if for example, Amazon's policy was, if you don't let us implement our own payment, then screw you. And then I would say it's in Apple's interest not to ever do that, because we could say, well, you implementing your own payment system would make it worse for our customers. So it's not actually, we're not benefiting our customers so long you do this, so forget it. But then that would mean like Marvel Unlimited and all these other, like Comixology had white label versions of their apps to the other people. So I don't know how that's going to work out now that Amazon owns them. But there's a potential for other people in the market to say, well, we'll do a deal for the people who own these comics and we will sell comics electronically and we will let them you buy them from within our app. And you would see the people who are into comics say, well, screw Comixology. I'm not using them anymore. You can't even buy inside the app. I'm going to this other thing, or I'm going to the subscription plan, like those ones where you pay a monthly fee and you can read X number of comics. Like, competition, hopefully, at least in the realm of comics, maybe not in the realm of books or anything else, would make it so that other people would spring up and say, well, you're not willing to pay Apple 2%, but I think 2% is a reasonable transaction fee, and we're going to pay it, and now everyone's going to come to our app, and no one's going to buy through your thing because they don't want to go to your website to buy stuff.
I'm looking at, you know, just what effects these kind of decisions would have on the entire iOS ecosystem and on all developers and all users of it. And I don't see a scenario here where Apple could make a change that would dramatically improve the situation with Amazon stuff and would be a net benefit and would, you know, wouldn't have too high a cost in user satisfaction. You know, even ignoring the money Apple would lose on that reduced or lost commission. I don't see this as being a net win. I see, you know, bad people taking advantage of it and an erosion of trust in buying iOS apps and paying for things on iOS, which should reduce customer satisfaction.
What would the bad people do with a reduced rate based on volume or otherwise?
Yeah, the reduced rate, that's something that I think would probably only negatively affect Apple, but I also don't see Amazon taking that deal. And you're right, maybe someone else will, and maybe that'll be the situation. But see, I don't see the big need for this. I mean, you know, people are mad this week. They'll be over it next week. And even now, most of the anger is going to Comixology and Amazon. Apple's not even getting hit by most of it.
Yeah, but the customer satisfaction with their iPads goes down. They're less satisfied with their product. I mean, like, maybe it's like it doesn't reflect on Apple. Maybe they blame Comixology. But what if they, the next time they need to buy a tablet, that by then they have long since heard that this isn't a problem on Android, and they read, you know, comics there and can buy them right in the app, maybe that will change their decision. Like, it's small, but it's, you know, these little things add up. Books, I think, is bigger. The Kindle app is bigger, and the Kindle app has the advantage that I'm pretty sure you can never buy them inside the Kindle app. So it's not like anything was ever taken away. But if people find out that, oh, if you get a Kindle Fire, you can buy within the app, that may attract them more to a Kindle Fire, especially if they start using their tablet mainly as a Kindle device.
I feel like, and you might have even said this earlier, because the iPad, or maybe it was Marco, because the iPad is so much better than everything else on the market, I don't think that customer sat will be influenced negatively enough to level the playing field.
You're probably right, and that's what Apple is counting on too, but these little things add up. And I was going to say that Sam the Geek in the chat room says that the white label versions of Comixology are keeping their in-app purchase. But like I said, now that Amazon owns them, I wonder how long those white label versions of Comixology app are going to be in the world at all. But clearly the people who are currently using them, I think the companies that put out the comics themselves actually white label them. Those people are highly motivated to get away for people with iOS devices to be able to easily buy their comics. And apparently they have been willing to pay the 30%. I assume they will continue to be willing to do the 30%. And that could be a way that Apple, quote unquote, wins this one by basically saying, well, no one will use Comixology anymore. We'll still get 30% and we'll get 30% from these other people instead. That's potentially true as well. Like, I'm just tired of the game of chicken. I feel like it's gone on for too many years. And I don't want to see apps coming onto the platform and just, we'll all just assume, well, of course you can't buy within the application. Of course you have to do this dance to go through a website. And then like little kid's going to ask me, Grandpa, why can't I buy things inside applications? I'm going to say, well, 10 decades ago, 3 decades ago, however old, I can't do math anymore because I'm old. Apple decided that they wanted to charge everybody 30%, and everyone else decided they weren't going to pay it. And Apple still makes the best tablets, but we have to do this because of a fight between these giant corporations.
Wow. We are also sponsored this week by our friends once again at New Relic. New Relic is an all-in-one web application performance management /APM tool. It lets you see performance from the end user experience through your servers and down to each line of your server-side code. Nowadays, if you're in any business, you're in the software business. Software powers our apps, runs our databases, manages our accounts, runs e-commerce sites, and runs email programs. When software breaks, everyone loses. New Relic helps improve your software performance so your users have a better experience and your business is more successful. How is that for a win-win? Or if you're John Siracusa, a win-win-win. New Relic monitors every move your application makes. I don't understand that. What is a win-win-win? Is that, who are the three people in that?
Customers, Amazon, and Apple.
Oh, okay. But I've heard that in other businesses. Is it always just like that kind of like two companies and the customer kind of thing?
That's three parties, yeah.
Weird. New Relic monitors every move your application makes across the entire stack and shows you what's happening right now. You can zero in on problems quickly with transaction tracing, SQL and NoSQL performance analytics, application topology mapping, and deployment history markers and comparisons. You can sign up today at newrelic.com/ATP for a 30-day free trial. All you got to do is deploy their agent, and that natively supports Ruby, PHP, Java, .NET, Python, and even Node. Their agent starts collecting data immediately, and you can quickly see inside your app to start finding hotspots, fixing issues, and optimizing your performance. Once again, go to newrelic.com/ATP for a free 30-day trial. Thanks a lot to New Relic for sponsoring our show once again.
So are we done in the comics thing that we don't have anything to say about?
I didn't listen to the Back to Work episode yet. I'm still behind, so I don't know what Merlin had to say about it. But sorry if I repeated any of the stuff that he said.
He mostly took like the kind of middle moderate ground of like, this is all more complicated than we understand. And, you know, we kind of shouldn't be making assumptions like we understand everything going on with these big companies.
Okay, well, I guess we didn't overlap. Although we did talk about like, you know, I tried to add disclaimers as far as we know, because who knows like what overtures any one company is making to Apple? Who knows what response Apple is making to them? We just know what these people announce publicly and what they end up doing.
I don't think this issue is going to be resolved anytime soon between, you know, Apple with their 30% rules and their no external payment processing rules versus Amazon and their desires versus customers and their experience. I just, you know, the Kindle app has been this way for years and it has not budged. And neither side has budged at all. So I don't see that changing for a very similar app with the same parties involved that has a much smaller audience. I just don't see it changing.
The volume discount thing has the advantage that it lets everybody pretend that they didn't budge. Because Apple can say, well, we still apply the same rules to everybody. And other people say, well, we weren't going to do it, but we got Apple to change the rules. And now, you know, because what that encourages is you are encouraged to drive more business through iOS. Sell tons of crap, because the more stuff you sell, the lower our percentage goes. And so that would let everybody save face. And like you said, maybe it wouldn't bring Amazon back to the table. But even if you ignore Amazon, if they're going to be butts about it, then fine. Tons of other people would be like, oh, now I am much more highly motivated to figure out a way to sell goods through the App Store, because I'm like, if I just sell a little bit of them, fine. But if I sell tons of them, the percentage that gets taken goes down. Unfortunately, the people selling the most stuff through the App Store are, you know, the companies you mentioned who are using the existing in-app purchase system to sell digital coins to people for bazillions of dollars. And
right. Yeah. Well, and there too, like, there's pretty much, like, besides Amazon, what other major examples are there that would have enough of an impact that are inconveniencing customers enough and are bad enough and inconvenient enough for customers that Apple would be more pressured to act beyond just, let's just keep our 30% because it's working great for us?
Yeah, I mean, you're looking for potential things. Like, if Apple wants some people to buy things through iPads, and I think they should, because I think that's a great way to buy a lot of content that can be digital. And I think it should use a single unified system that Apple controls for in-app purchases, so everyone isn't like, all the things about it that we like. If there was more of that, it would be better. So anybody who's got anything to sell that could potentially find its way through the invisible airwaves to your iPad should be encouraged to do so. Someone in the chat room brought up, like, you have to look where the revenue is coming from. If it's all coming from the big guys, then they wouldn't want to change the rate, because then Apple would be losing money. Like, why would Apple ever give a volume discount if all their income or a huge amount of their income is coming from the big guys? Yeah, Apple would make less money. Like, this is the problem with this whole thing, is that people used to be like, oh, Apple runs the iTunes store at break even and it's not really a profit center. And oh, no, the App Store is like, yeah, they take a cut, but it's really just enough to keep the lights on. But it has always been like Apple's, I don't know if it's their secret strategy or whatever, but it's been pretty clear, like, you could see Apple 5 years ago rubbing their hands together saying, yes, ignore our break-even businesses. They're totally not there to make money. It's just to make our devices more valuable. They know that it is, you know, this is what you want. The type of system where we don't have to do anything more and we magically get money. Like, people can drive more and more money through our systems. Like, we like that. The margin is better than having to make another metallic widget to sell to somebody. It's much easier to just simply let someone tap another button and get another 30% cut of a transaction that's going through our system. And lo and behold, years down the line, suddenly Apple's businesses like iTunes and stuff that were, oh, we just run at break even, are starting to make some significant money. And the App Store, same thing. Like, oh, it starts out as just enough for us to cover our costs or whatever. But I have a feeling that Apple would like it if these businesses stopped being break even and started making some serious money. And while people aren't paying attention, that's where they're going. So any potential plan that says, oh, we're going to give you less revenue because of your volume discount, it's like Apple might be thinking, well, I know we've always kind of pretended this is like a break even business, but if we're going to do this, it might actually be a break even business. And we're not Amazon. We actually want profits. So there are forces against any idea like this, but it's almost like I wish it would hurt them more, because you're right that it's not hurting them enough that it's clear that they have to do this or they're going to be out of business or they're doomed. That's totally not the case. It's just like it's just like a little thorn in your side where you know it could be better. And someday you are going to have to explain to your mom who got a Kindle Fire when she gets her iPad, oh, get the iPad, it's better. But on my Kindle Fire, I can buy the books and the thing. And you will have to explain that to her. And good luck making it sound reasonable. It's impossible. It's not reasonable. Apple's product is worse in this one small way. And it galls me.
Or she'll just get an iPad and just buy things in iBooks.
That's a fate worse than death.
All right. Thanks a lot to our three sponsors this week, Fracture, Backblaze, and New Relic. And we will see you next week.
Now the show is over. They didn't even mean to begin, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. John didn't do any research. Marco and Casey wouldn't let him, because it was accidental. Oh, it was accidental. And you can find the show notes at atp.fm. And if you're into Twitter, you can follow them at CASEYLIS. S-S, so that's Casey Liss, M-A-I-C-O-A-R-M-E-N-T, Marco Arment, S-I-R-A-C-U-S-A, Syracuse, it's accidental.
You want to talk about this weird test flight thing that we've been putting off forever? It's really old news now.
I've forgotten what it is, man.
So Bursley was acquired. Do we even know? Like, is there any actual confirmation that Apple was the acquirer?
The internet said so.
Right. Like, I think even that is not definite, like not confirmed. But test flight basically just like very quietly shut down. Like, it stopped accepting new applicants or new customers to beta test the apps with it, and it's just like quietly shutting down, and they never made an announcement about this. They never explained it. It's just like a very, very quiet shutdown. And so the theory is that Apple bought them, and they're probably going to integrate, you know, maybe first party, maybe Apple might actually integrate test flight like functionality into the provisioning portal for iOS apps so that we could stop doing the stupid UDID dance with things like hockey and test flight and other beta testing type things. But I don't know. Like, I would love for that to be the case. I would love for the story with test flight to be that Apple's building something like this in, and that's why it's shutting down. But Bursley was also a big mobile ad company, right? Wasn't that, or analytics, one of those things? So Apple might have wanted it for that, and TestFlight was this little side project they had that wasn't making any money, so Apple just, you know, made them quietly shut it down. Like, it could be any of these things.
I would put money that they're going to do the thing that TestFlight did inside Apple, just because it makes so much sense. That, I mean, anytime you see a bunch of third-party sites popping up that developers are using, like lots of developers using Hockey App, lots of developers are using TestFlight, Apple hates that. if there's something that, you know, third-party developers need to be done, there should not be a thriving ecosystem of companies that serve these developers' needs to do these things the thing they're doing is something like it's common. So Apple wants to eventually have a solution to do that. If they bought this company and this company did that, I would say it's almost guaranteed that what they're trying to do is get something in-house that does similar to what the thing that they did.
See, I don't know. I'm probably, this is probably just like,
you're saying nothing can ever get better in the App Store, but it can sometimes.
Yeah, it's some kind of psychological like barrier that I have, where especially in areas like this, like the provisioning of devices, the UDID limits, the, you know, beta testing being such a pain, I can't fathom Apple actually making a major improvement to this. And I would love to be proven wrong.
They'll probably still give you a fixed list of IDs that only rotates at a certain, you know, there will still be plenty of things to annoy you, I'm sure. But like, just the general experience of provisioning and the ability for people to easily download betas and distribute them. Like, I'm assuming they will fix some of the annoyances, but I guarantee there'll be more that remain. Just don't worry. Code signing will still be terrible. So you'll have that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, like, I've heard rumblings here and there from the rumor sites and everybody that, like, you know, this might finally be the year where Apple like really makes things better for developers in the App Store side. Like, you know, the tools side, like the Xcode is fantastic. It's been improved a lot. Objective-C, the language has been improved a lot. You know, all the tools are really great. But then you cross over into like the provisioning and the iTunes Connect and the App Store rules and the pricing, you know, mechanism and, you know, upgrades and trials and all that stuff that developers have been wanting forever. I have like no faith that Apple will ever improve that stuff, because they just haven't. Like, the App Store has been running now for 6 years, 5 years, and this stuff has almost not changed at all. There have been very minor changes.
But don't you think they've been kind of in the middle of a multi-year arc where they've been adding lots of stuff so fast that they haven't been had enough time to essentially make it work?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there's the iOS thing, and there's like, they've been doing a lot of stuff to code signing, provisioning profiles and betas and like, and sandboxing and the sandbox bookmarks on the Mac for opening up. Like, they're adding all sorts of things you can do and revving their compiler toolchain. And like, they've kind of been outrunning themselves, leaving a trail of crappy half implemented things behind them. Hopefully at some point they will get to a point where they can circle back and say, and that's what I hope they're doing by buying TestFlight. It's like, okay, we had a way to do this before. The way sucked for years. Now we finally have a chance to take a breath and say, let's go back. And instead of adding a new capability, let's merely make it less incredibly unpleasant to do with something that you could previously do You know what I mean? And I'm hoping that they're at that point. I mean, iOS 8 may be a move in that direction as well, now that we're over the 7 hump, you know, so we'll see.
Yeah, maybe. I hope you're right. I don't have high hopes, or I don't have a lot of faith, but I hope you're right.
It might not be this year. It could be next year.
Yeah, maybe.
Anything else going on?
Nope.
I quietly relaunched my website that's not on Tumblr anymore.
What is the URL?
www.caseylist.com. Really inventive. And that's my second crack, or third crack, if you will. I don't really have a name for it, but
what is the directory called for the project? It has to have something.
It does. It's Camel, CAMEL, which is a portmanteau? I don't know how to pronounce the word, but you see it on Wikipedia all the time. It's a mash of my first and middle names. But anyway, so that's all written in Node, and everyone's probably breaking it now, and that's okay.
So what's it going to take to get you off of the using your last name as a pun thing? Is that an impossible task?
It's never going to happen. No, I mean, I couldn't think of a good name. And I was so that site in many ways is kind of a mashup of underscores and your two sites, both in terms of inspiration for CSS, inspiration for layout, things of that nature. And so I looked at underscore site after I had decided to call this Thoughtless, and he just calls his David Smith. And obviously there's Hypercritical, there's Marco.org. I didn't like CaseyList.com. I don't have a fancy pants name like Hypercritical that I've been using for forever. So I don't know. This was the first thing that I came up with that didn't make me gag, but I'm not in love with it either. So
didn't you read that whole post that you wrote about not doubting yourself? You should not have a title of the thing that says that you're thoughtless.
I knew that was coming. That's why I'm not in love with what I've got here, but that's all right.
Yeah, see, I've never seen you use the list last name pun in a way that wasn't self-deprecating.
Well, yeah, and that's kind of my shtick.
Well, because it sounds like less, and there's not a lot of good words. Less.
Yeah.
Weightless. I don't know. Whatever. But anyway, this is Node, and I've been piddling with it a little bit lately. Let me do a clock on it. 405 lines of code. Basically, the way it works is there's a series of markdown files in directories that match the directories you see in the URLs. And then there's a header and footer markdown file. And so if you go to any of these URLs, and during Fireball style, if you put .md at the end, it'll show you the source. And so I have a little bit of metadata at the top. And then other than that, it just processes the markdown files, throws on a header, throws on a footer, and calls it a day. And so it's 405 lines of Node using several packages, because I haven't yet been horribly burned by third-party software. And I know, I'm pretty proud of it. I like it. It's not flawless, but I like it. I should call it Flawless. That's what I should call it.
There you go. Finally, you figure one out that is not self-deprecating.
No, because that has flaw in it. It's like the flawless. Is this a list with the flaw? It's not. It doesn't. It's like you can't use the last name as a pun.
I know. I got to think of a better name.
That's great. Even your brag had you know, a self-deprecating root in it.
If this software didn't use Markdown, I might replace mine with it, but it does, so I won't.
What's wrong with Markdown?
I don't like it.
You're a purist, right? Don't you write everything in actual HTML straight?
I find it better in all ways than writing in a markdown. I don't want to go through another translation. I'm going to publish HTML. I know how to write HTML. I write it. I publish it. I don't have to say, how is this going to transform? I don't need to do like a transformation. It's just, I don't know. That's how I work. I don't not say that everyone else has to do that, but that's the way I do it. But anyway, most people seem to like Markdown, and so they make all these apps that work with Markdown, and if you don't want to use Markdown, it's not good.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm going to phrase this wrong, but Markdown is HTML? No, that's the other way around.
Yeah, I know. You can just write HTML and Markdown too, but it's like, once I'm doing that, then what the hell's the point?
Well, so what I'm saying is, so if you look at any one of these URLs and put the .md at the end, so I'm looking at the ATP shirts one as an example, you would have to have the @ and then, you know, the couple of metadata entries, but everything below that can all be straight HTML.
Yeah, this looks like my thing. Like, I have the same format, only I don't have @ats. I just have metadata on the top. I just use the mail format where the first blank line ends the header section. And then I have the HTML.
Yeah, I do something similar, which is I have like header format on top. Keep talking. I'll show you one of mine. mine's weird, but it makes sense to me.
So, and that's what this is about. It made sense to me. I wanted to try something that I hadn't done before, which is Node, and I like the code. I don't love the code. A part of me wants to throw it on GitHub and embarrass myself, but I really want to fix a few things up before I do it. Like, for example, it's a good thing I only have two posts on there, because if I go past, I don't know, 10, it's going to look ridiculous because I don't do pagination at the moment.
You'll figure that out.
Yeah, I mean, I actually already have a plan. I just haven't implemented it yet. I'm going to do like the world's worst pagination, which is kind of a loose pagination. Once I get it worked out, maybe we'll talk about it in another after show. But yeah, so I'm pretty proud of it. It's white, not because, oh, it's Casey, he always says white. It's white because I couldn't figure out a background color that I wanted.
It's white, of course.
But I don't know. I felt like I needed to spend all this time like working out better CSS, because I suck at CSS. And for a brief moment, like, I thought about copying the Marco, you know, one color at the top and then everything else below. And then I looked at it the way it was, and I was like, you know, it's good enough. Why fuss over it? So I'm pretty proud of it, as simple as it is, and maybe I'll open source it, maybe I won't.
If you're even thinking about showing this code to anybody, it is a lot better than the code that's running my chat, because I would never show it to anybody. I don't even like looking at it myself.
It's bad, but it's not awful. There's definitely a lot of places where it could be cleaned up and spruced up and made a lot cleaner. I'm repeating myself in several places. But by and large, I don't think it's terrible. I mean, to be honest, how bad can you really screw up 405 lines of JavaScript, leaving aside the fact that it's JavaScript?
I've seen a lot of bad JavaScript.
Right.
It's definitely possible.
And the other thing is this, and I'm looking at the source that you pasted in the chat, Marco. This is not a link blog. I have no support for like a link post versus a regular post. But so it's just a blog, but I don't know. I dig it so far.
Yeah, I don't have any support for link things either. Not that I ever post them. But I mean, if I did, I would guess I would go and add support, whatever. Here's the real problem with adding links. Everyone has already used up all the obvious characters for indicating links.
Yep. I completely agree. I 100% agree.
That is 100% the problem.
Well, you could steal my arrow afterwards stuff. Is it arrow after or arrow before?
It's not your arrow. Everybody uses the arrow, and then Daring Fireball uses a star for none, and a lot of other people use it. Everyone uses the infinity for permalinks, and it's just like there's no more glyphs left, so the game over.
Well, what's wrong with just using the standard glyphs that everyone else uses?
Because you want to be different, Marco. You want to be your own special snowflake.
Exactly. You want to be a brand.
Well, you can't be your own special snowflake, because that's Dr. Dre.
The real problem with link blogs, I think, is that, you know, whether there's two problems. Number one is like what the feed items link to. No matter which option you pick, people will be upset and confused. It's just different people.
Yep, that's true.
So that's one problem. Like, there's no good solution to that. The other problem is when you choose a title and a length of the post, it's confusing as to whether you wrote this, whether that's your title of your post, or then like some people will get to your link post permalink page and not realize that big title at the top is a link to something else.
Well, I mean, you can avoid that by not making the title be a link to anything on the page when you're viewing it. You know what I mean? When you're viewing just the page that just shows that story, the title is not a link. Every place else, the title is a link, and then you have to choose where you want it to go. But I would say you'd make it go to the, you know, I don't know. It's
like, where does the link go in a link post on its permalink page?
I would mostly say it goes to the story. Like, I like the idea of linking from the text that you write to the thing you're talking about and not relying on the title to fill that role.
Then it's kind of redundant, but then, I don't know. Like, the big problem with link blogging is that all of these questions, like, there's no clear good solution. Like, whatever you pick is going to have issues.
Yeah, you just have to pick one, and people just have to get used to it.
Yeah.
The RSS one is worse, but most people don't seem to use RSS anymore these days, so that kind of takes care of itself.
I just use both. I have an alternate feed in my footer that has the other link style.
I just noticed that earlier today, which I'd never seen before, obviously. The other thing I wanted to talk about briefly about this was how I'm hosting it. which is to say that I put it on Heroku because for a one web dyno, as they call it, it is absolutely free. And from what I can tell, this didn't get absolutely crushed under the load of the live listeners. But what was unique to me was that when I went to deploy to Heroku, having never used Heroku before, I looked at how to do it. And what it amounted to was I needed to add a proc file to my source, which specifies that it is a website, not like a worker or anything like that, and its node and which node file to run. I needed to clean up my package JSON, which defines what my dependencies are. But that was it. And then I pushed to a Git repository that they set up, and suddenly I had a website.
All right, now I'm not using your system anymore because I thought it was generating static files, but I forgot that you're actually using it. Code runs when you, yeah, no, I got to have static.
Well, and so basically everything is generated on the fly lazily, but once it's generated, it's held in memory for some amount of time, I don't recall. So you're right, it isn't static, but nevertheless, I would assume that it should hold up to some pretty heavy load.
Well, you can do the cruddy thing, which I considered doing before I decided even this was too much work, which make a system that dynamically generates web pages and then just crawl it yourself to create your static pages and then just upload the static ones.
Maybe it's my own ignorance coming through, but if I have everything in memory, how is it going to be that hard to answer a gazillion requests? Like, it's all there. It's rendered HTML in memory. I just got to look it up from a hash and dump it to the request or to the response object. So what else is there to worry about?
Well, that's the thing. I mean, with all these static blogging systems, static blogging is really great, but and I use it on my site, but you can get almost all of the benefit from just caching. I mean, because static blogging, you have to change a few things. If you do static, one of the main things is you have to serve the same markup to everybody and the same, like, you have to serve the same content for every hit. You can't do server-side browser detection or device detection and altering what you send, you know, mobile layout separately. Like, you have to serve everyone the same markup. But with responsive design and with the removal of comments, or even outsourcing comments to other services like Disqus, where you just embed a static JavaScript link and the thing works. You know, if you relegate all dynamic functionality to JavaScript embeds or to CSS with responsive design, then it works. Now, you can do that exact same thing either through a static system or just put like a caching proxy in front of your server and, you know, put like, you know, Varnish or Nginx in caching mode, you know, put those in front of your server, just have it cache every hit for 1 second. That's it. Cache every page it serves with a TTL of 1 second, and you'll be able to tolerate almost every possible flood of traffic you will ever get, even if the thing is being generated from a database on every hit that actually gets through. It's static blogging, it does offer high performance, but it also just offers a pretty strong degree of simplicity for deployment.
That's what's going to get it. Like, I'm not doing it for performance reasons. I'm doing it because I'm cheap, and because then you can deploy anywhere. Super, like, I don't need anything to run any code. And that's like, it's not just cheap, but like, you have the most options. Like, it will literally work everywhere. There is no, you don't need to run anything. You don't need to have any in software. There is no software. Like, that's, I mean, static blogging is not done for performance reasons. It's just mostly for, just, you have all the options in the world. It's going to work everywhere on every single hosting system you could possibly imagine. And yes, it will also happen to be performant on all of them, but that's not really why you're doing it. Like, it just keeps...
But hold on, though. There is software. They just move it. I mean, that's the thing. Like you said, there is no software, but unless you're actually writing HTML pages, which most people are not doing, there absolutely is software involved, and that has to be maintained, and it has to run somewhere. It's just running on your computer, like, you know, like the thing that generates the files.
Oh, yeah, no, yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, but you control that. Like, it's not, your deployment options are unlimited. You can move from one hosting provider to another. You don't have to worry if they don't support Node.js or have a different version or make some sort of complicated thing. You need a different deployment. It's like, you just are files somewhere, and that's, you know, and if you have a site that actually gets traffic, then you don't have to worry about this, then fine, write some code, deploy it. But like, my site doesn't get any traffic. I want the cheapest possible thing I can possibly get, and that ends up being static hosting. And, you know, yeah, but you get what you pay for. But that's why I did it static, not because I was looking for performance. Although, like, occasionally I do get traffic bursts, and it's nice that I don't have to worry about them because, again, it's static. I don't even use, like, it is super static. It's not, some people are like, well, it's static, but I use, like, you know, some server-side include system or something to put in headers. Nope, 100% static.
Yeah, and that's the thing is that, it, admittedly, this is dynamic the first run. But like I said, you know, as soon as I've parsed the markdown for any of these pages, it's held in memory for at least half an hour, if not more than that, until I either deliberately toss the cache or, you know, it times out or whatever. So this isn't a challenge or anything like that, but I feel like I should, in principle, be able to to handle a crud load of traffic without crumbling.
Yeah, you should. But it's like yours is static in the respect that really matters for performance, and that you're not like talking to a database. For example, like it, the files that you're reading are static. They just happen to be filled with markdown, and you do a little bit of post processing in memory, and it's not even like Node is a single process, like event driven, right?
Yep.
It's a single process in the system. So you don't even have to worry about your cache getting divided through Apache children or some other concern that you might have with, yeah, so you're fine. And really, just like me, no one's going to read your blog, so we're both fine.
Except really, no one's going to read my blog, whereas nobody reads yours.
We can compete. You'd be surprised how few people read my blog.
Well, you never post, which...
That's that exactly. If you never post anything, nobody reads it. I don't know how that works.
And admittedly, I'm not good at that either, and I'm hoping this will make me better, but I don't know. So yeah, it was a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to do. I'm still very impressed with how unbelievably simple Heroku was to deploy to, because truly I had heard of it, but never really done anything with it. And it must have been well under half an hour, maybe even under 15 minutes between the time I said, you know what, let me just see if I can throw this on Heroku and if it'll work. And the time that I had it not only up there, but I had updated my DNS to point to it. It was unbelievably quick and easy. And that really is awesome.
Yeah, but is it $5 a month?
It's $0 a month.
Oh, that's right. You're doing that. Yeah.
Yeah, he's beating you, John.
Yeah, I guess that's true. But then he's stuck deploying someplace that supports Node.js.
You know, they also support PHP.
Oh, great. But what are the limits? Like, when do you have to start paying?
I honestly don't know. I mean, basically, if I add more web front ends, then that costs money. But in terms of like bandwidth, or I don't know if after 30 gigs used or something like that.
Well, you're not going to hit the bandwidth limit. It might be like CPU time or something. What we need to do is get one of your stories to go up on like Hacker News and like a bunch of other sites simultaneously, so in the Daring Fireball link, and Marco will link it, and like everyone will tweet it, and we'll see if you get into the pay zone. Because okay, like even though I don't have anything on my blog, no posting, every once in a while some random story will land on some social media site, and all of a sudden I'll have a spike. It's not a big spike, but it's big enough that I would worry that I would go out of the free zone and start getting charged some crazy amount of money.
I love how that's how the world control Casey, by making him popular.
Yeah, we need to test the system here, right?